All righty then. Good evening. Erev Tov. Okay, so our goal tonight on this one-off is to look at the Arba Banim, the four sons that are, the famous four sons that are presented in the Haggadah. And we're going to look at it a bit in light of how it is that we studied Hilchot Deot, because we find the terms there, but also to be able to understand it in terms of freedom, because it's important to recognize that the Chagim, that are Mu'adim, the days of our year that we spend on special times, are as they sound. A Mu'ad is literally an appointment in time. It's a time that is specified in the calendar that we meet up with over and over again as we go through the cycles of years in our life. And we have these appointments with God. Right? It's literally what Mu'ad means. As opposed to spatially, we will talk about Ohel Mu'ad, right? The tent, the appointed tent. This is where I meet God in a spatial capacity. The Mu'adim are where I meet God in a temporal capacity in terms of time. And so the Hachamim always, the Torah has always essentially seen us as moving through time as opposed to time moving past us, and that we meet up with these points over and over and over again in a cyclical fashion, except that each time we meet it at a different level. So if you would envision a spiral staircase, we're going around and around at the same coordinates, but each time we're doing it on a different level. And so we will meet up with Pesach and Sukkot and Shavuot and so on and so forth over and over and over again. And each one of the Mu'adim presents to us another aspect of our humanity, our relationship with God, and ultimately the development of ourselves as people in terms of our relationship with God and our own lives. Pesach is our first. It's our first appointment of the year. Although Rosh Hashanah is called Rosh Hashanah, it all depends on how it is that you look at your year. There are different years, right? There's fiscal years, there's school years, there's all kinds of different years. And the year, as far as the Mu'adim are concerned, right, as far as these appointments are concerned, begins with Pesach. Rosh Hashanah comes in the seventh month, not in the first month. Nisan is the first month. As far as judgment is concerned, as far as looking at our lives as a whole, in terms of how it is that we see ourselves in full capacity, that has to do with Rosh Hashanah. We look at it from one Rosh Hashanah to the next. But in terms of our celebration and engagement of points in the year that we have these appointments with God, it begins with Pesach. And Pesach is a Mu'ed, it is a festival of freedom. And so everything that we do on that festival addresses freedom, works on freedom, brings the questions of freedom to light, in not only psychologically and cognitively, but in terms of our actions. Right? So these are exercises in freedom. So what we're going to look at tonight is one section of the Haggadah. There are two major mitzvot on Pesach that come from the Torah that we still have today, and all the other mitzvot that we do on Pesach night come from the Chachamim. They come from the rabbis. The two mitzvot that come from the Torah is the telling of the story of leaving Egypt and coming into freedom, or slavery to freedom. And the other is to eat matzah, that we have to eat the matzah on Pesach night. Everything else, the four cups, the leaning, the karpas, the haroset, all of these things that we do are instituted by the Chachamim, and we keep all of them in tandem and fulfill our night of Pesach to Seder. In the telling of the story, there is text that is provided for us by the Chachamim, right? By our sages. And in this text, which is what we call the Haggadah, right? The Haggadah proper. And in this text is this presentation of what they call the Arba'a Banim. It says, Keneged Arba'a Banim Dibra Torah. When speaking of our exodus, when speaking of our freedom, the Torah presents it in four modes, in four ways, and it is seen as essentially being presented to four different types of quote-unquote children, but not children, offspring, right? Progeny, that would ask the parent questions. And how is it that I'm relating to and referring to this child, right? How do I respond to the child in terms of this? What I'd like to do with you is look at this in the Haggadah, and we're also going to look at it in the Torah, because when the Haggadah says, Keneged arba'a banim dibra Torah, which means the Torah spoke in response to four different types of children. I don't want to say children, right? These four different types of... Anyway, they're people. But it is important to be able to recognize it in terms of ben, right? In terms of one's child, because this is how it is that we teach and how it is that we give things over. But in any case, it's drawing from the Torah. When it says, Keneged arba'im banim dibra Torah, the Torah spoke in corresponding to these four types. They're drawing from verses in the Torah. There are four places in the Torah where it seems like the Torah is saying, this is what you will tell your children regarding the leaving of Egypt. And they look at these four different places, and they say, it seems that the Torah is speaking to four different types of individuals. Yeah? Four different types of individuals. So what we're going to do, we're going to look at this, we're going to examine it, and we're going to try in the time that we have. I told you it's a little longer tonight. Told you. Going to go till 9:45 tonight. Yes, it is. And you're free to walk straight out at any point that you wish. But I'll be going at least until 9:45. So, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the Torah. We're going to look at the Haggadah. We're going to look at the Psukim in the Torah that the Haggadah comes from in our sources. And we're going to try and understand what it is, why it is that the Hachamim said what it is that they said, and what we're supposed to get from it with regards to our relationship to the world and to freedom. So let's take a look at our source sheets. I'm sorry that it's all in Hebrew, but I will translate as we go along. This is our source sheet. Two columns, yes? Okay, the top of the source sheet is taken straight out of the Haggadah. Okay, what we will read on Pesach night. And it starts, Baruch HaMakom Shenatan Torah Le'amo Yisrael. Baruch Hu. Blessed is... literally, the place, capital P, right? So it's referring to God as Makom here. Throughout the Haggadah, very often in the Haggadah, it refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Makom. Just as a small side, I will say, we'll get into why it is that God is referred to that way here, but as a small aside, always space or domain is a word that comes from authority. So domain and dominance and dominion all come from the same source, which is why in Latin we will call Lord Domini or Dominus. Yeah? And so the concept of domain or dominion, yeah, dominate, these all come from the same source, and the one who dominates essentially is the Lord. It's the same thing in Hebrew. We will use the word, for example, reshut. The word reshut refers to the authority of government. Reshut is also the word that we use for license in Hebrew, right? Reshut is also the authority. And we will also talk about God in terms of Reshut. Achamim will say, for example, that one has to be very careful not to say Shema twice in a row, because it sounds like he is speaking to Shte Reshuyot. He's speaking to two authorities, right? Chas v'shalom. And we know that there is only one. So Makom, yes, the place, is talking about God as the ultimate place for the universe and the world, within which the entire universe exists. And we are saying, blessed is the Makom that gave Torah to his nation Israel, Baruch Hu, blessed is he. Keneged arba banim, dibra Torah. Torah spoke in corresponding to four different banim. One, a hacham, one, a wise individual. Ehad, rasha. The other, a wicked individual. The third, a Tam, not that his name is Tam. A Tam in Hebrew is that he is neither here nor there, average, not bad, not particularly good, kind of middle of the road kind of guy. Simple, but it's not simple in the sense of where he's a simpleton, yeah? I mean, he's not a Chacham, but he's a regular individual. She'eno yodeh lishol, and then there's a person who does not know enough even to begin asking questions. Right, so there is that as well, where I don't have enough information even to know what to ask. Yeah, and that's a she'eno yodeh lishol, and it's looking at these people in terms of their relationship to Torah, to Israel, to our story, to our future, to our history, and so on. How do we engage with regards to these things? So let's take a look at how it is that they bring it. So the Chacham, Mahu Omer, Right? So I said, let's start with Hacham. We'll start with the wise one. What does he say? Yeah, what does it mean, what does he say? What does he say to what? Well, what does he say with regards to this entire thing, right? Pesach night, our exile, our liberation, our redemption, our freedom, the fact that we are the nation that we are only because of that. What does it mean to be Israel? All of this. What does he say? Mahu Omer. What is his... But when he says, what does he say? It's essentially saying, what's his perspective? Right? So when you say, what do you say? What do you say? It's not just saying, what is the words that you think to say? It's, oh, well, what's your approach to this? What is your thinking in terms of this? So the Hacham says this. Ma ha'edot v'achukim v'amishpatim asher tziva Adonai Eloheinu etchem. What are the different laws? Hukim, mishpatim, edot. He talks about all different kinds of laws. Right? There are different types of legal elements in the Torah. He specifies each one of them. He doesn't just say, what are the mitzvot? He talks about edot, hukim, mishpatim, different elements. That God, our Lord, Shem Eloheinu, he says, our Lord, commanded etchem, you. Okay, so he's talking in terms of other, right? He's talking to someone. He's referring to God as being our God, but he's saying, what did he command you? Didn't say, what did he command us, interestingly. Now, look at the parenthesis, Devarim Vav Kaf, yes? Okay, let's take a look down, skip down, see where it says Hacham on the halfway down on the first column? That's Devarim Vav Kaf. Okay, so that is where the Hacham is, the Hacham's words in the Haggadah are drawn from. They're taking it from the book of Deuteronomy in the sixth chapter, and they're implanting that into the Haggadah, saying, when we read these verses in the Torah, we think Hacham. The one who must be saying this is Hacham. What does the Hacham say? Well, let's take a look at these psukim. You have it there, it's right in the middle of the first column, Hacham, yeah? Ki ish'alecha bancha mahar lemor. When your child or your son asks you tomorrow, meaning in the days that come, saying, Ma ha'edot v'achukim v'amishpatim asher tziva Adonai Eloheinu etchem. That's the Chacham's question, right? So the Torah is saying, by the way, who's speaking over here in Deuteronomy?
Moshe.
Moshe, right? This is Moshe's last speech to the people. And so he's saying, when your child, when your son asks you tomorrow, what are these hukim, edot, hukim, mishpatim, that God, our Lord, commanded you? Yeah? Ve'amarta lebincha. Well, it tells us what to answer him. Amarta lebincha. Well, what you should say to your child is, avadim hayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim. We were slaves. Good, you should ask. Let me explain to you what these hukim and mishpatim and so on are. We were slaves to Paro in Egypt. Vayotzienu Adonai mimitzrayim biyad hazaka. God took us out of Egypt with a strong arm. Vayiten Adonai otot moftim gedolim v'ra'im. He gave very great, powerful, and harsh signs and miracles to Egypt. Befaro, to Faro, b'chol beto, and all of his house, le'aynenu, in front of our eyes, he did this. Continues. Ve'otanu otzim isham. He took us out of there. Leman haviotanu, so that he should bring us, latet lanu, to give to us, et haaretz, the land asher nishba, lavotenu, that he swore to our forefathers to give us. Vaitzavenu Adonai lasod, and when he did that, he commanded us to do kol hachukim ha'ele, all of these laws, liyirat Adonai Eloheinu, to have fear of God, our Lord, letov lanu, so that it should be good for us, kol hayamim, all of our days, lehayotenu kayom hazeh, to bring us life, as he does this day, utzdakat yelanu, it is a righteous act for us that God does for us, kinshmor lasot, as we keep to do, et kol ha-mitzvah hazot, all of this commandment that he gives us, lifnei Adonai Eloheinu, we do so before the Lord our God, kasher tzivanu, as he commands. Quite a lengthy response. Basically, we give him the entire story, and we couch the mitzvot in terms of Yetziat Mitzrayim, in terms of leaving Egypt. Yes? Okay. Now, what do we answer? That's nice in the Torah. So it should be able to, you look at this, say, okay, if this is the question of the Hacham, I should answer the answer to the Hacham. Except that all the Haggadah does is it gets the question of the Hacham and gives a completely different answer. Take a look. What does the Haggadah say? Well, when your son asks you this, and he's the Hacham, this is what you say. Afatay morlo, kilchot ha-Pesach. Tell him the laws of Pesach. As a matter of fact, if you want to suffice with one, tell him, "En maftirin achar Pesach afikomin." We don't really eat anything after the afikomen on Pesach night. That's the response. So how did you get from this response in the Torah, which is the entire story of Yetziat Mitzrayim and the mitzvot being couched in terms of our freedom and our redemption, to, by the way, we don't eat anything after the matzah on Pesach night, last thing? Very strange, very strange. Okay, so that's one thing. The next one is the Rasha. Right? What does the Rasha say? Right? What is the wicked son, the son that's really not interested in any of this, actually rebels against the whole thing, you know, but he's at the table. What does he say? He says, "Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem." What is this service to you? What does it mean to you, basically? Now, the truth is, there's not a huge amount of difference between the Rasha and the Chacham in terms of the question. The Chacham definitely makes nuanced treatment to the mitzvot. The Rasha is just saying, what is this service, right? This work that you're doing over here, what is it to you? The Chacham also says etchem, except he doesn't say lachem, he just etchem. What did God, our Lord, command to you? And here the Rasha is saying, what is this to you? How do we answer him? Well, let's take a look at the Torah first, before we continue in the Haggadah. The Torah has this as well with Rasha. Vehaya ki omru alechem, you see it down there on the bottom of the Chacham, 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs from the bottom. Yes? Rasha says, "Ve'haya ki omru alechem b'nechem." When your children say to you, "Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem," there's the Rasha's question, right? "Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem," what is this service to you? Well, what do you say to them? Amartem. Well, what you should say to him is Zevach Pesach Hu L'Adonai. This is a slaughtering that we do to God because of Pesach. Why? Pesach Hu L'Adonai Asher Pesach Al Betei B'nei Yisrael B'Mitzrayim. He passed over, right? Passover. He passed over our houses in Egypt on the night that he went slaying the firstborn. B'Nokvot Mitzrayim V'Batinu Yisrael. He saved our houses and smote Egypt. That's the response to the question in the Torah. How do we respond to the question in the Haggadah? Well, first of all, I don't like the fact, you know, we don't like the fact that he says lachem. I mean, what's the matter? You're not included in this, that you say lachem? This is to you? What is it to you? What about you? You're not part of the family? You don't come in with all of this stuff? And so the Haggadah picks up on that. The Hachamim pick up on that. And they say, lachem ve'lo lo. I mean, by the fact that he says lachem, he's excluding himself. Lo lo. Lo with an aleph, lo with a vav, right? Not him. He's not including himself in the entire thing. And sfi shehotzi et atzmo min haklal, since he actively removed himself from the collective of Israel, saying, what is it to you? And he doesn't include himself in it, right? Kafar be'ikar. I mean, he clearly rejects the very core of the belief system of Israel. So he's completely out. I mean, this is not just your, you know, a slight, lack of adherence. This is essentially the Achamir saying, from this very question that was spoken about in the Torah, we recognize this person to be a heretic. Right? I mean, he's completely out. And what do we say to him? Well, afata haker chinav. Well, you sharpen that man's teeth. Right? Haker chinav. And you say to him, ba'avur ze asa Adonai li b'tzitim emitzrayim. It's because of this night and this chag and this festival that God did what he did for me in Mitzrayim. Right? Li ve'lo lo. Me, not you. And so much so, since you removed yourself from the people, and I can now talk to you in terms of me and not you, I will say to you, ilu hayasham, if this guy was actually in Egypt at the time, hilo haya nigal, he wouldn't have come out. Because he wouldn't have bought into the entire thing, right? I'm out because I bought in, my parents bought in, my ancestors bought in, and so on and so forth. He didn't. He wouldn't be in. Huh. Quite a different response than, I mean, it's very harsh, very, very serious. Then, of course, we have Tom. And Tom says, very simply, mazot. What is this? No nuance, no details, no anything. It's just very broad, open-ended question. What is this? Mazon. And we have that too in the Torah. Right? Over there, third paragraph from the bottom, in the first column, Vayakish alcha bincha mahar lemor mazot. And when your child asks you, what is this? Well, you say to him, Behozek yad hotziyanu l'naim Mitzrayim b'beit avadim. God took us out with an outstretched arm, with a strong arm, from the house of bondage. And how do we answer him in the Haggadah? Precisely that way. This one was fine. We kept the answer for this one. Amarta elav. Hozek yad hotziyanu l'naim b'beit avadim. Then, of course, you've got the She'eno Yodea Lishol. The She'eno Yodea Lishol says, At Pitachlo. Since he does not know how to ask the question, you ask for him. You teach him how to ask. Now, where do I get that from? There's a pasuk in the Torah that I draw from, that I hear this is what the question should be for this individual who's not asking in the first place because he doesn't know what to ask. He doesn't know where he is that he should ask. And we say, how do I know that I'm supposed to open up for my kid when he doesn't even know what to ask? It says in the Pasuk, tell your child on that day. Tell him. This is what you tell him. Where do we get that? We get that here from the final Pasuk in the Torah. It's because of this that God did for me when he took me out of Egypt. Yes? And you tell him that. But it doesn't stop there. That would be enough. That's what the Torah has. For some reason, we go on an entire Talmudic discourse with this child that doesn't know how to ask any questions. It says, V'igata libincha yachol merosh chodesh. I mean, I'm supposed to tell my son? Well, when am I supposed to tell my son? Could be from the time of Rosh Chodesh. I mean, from the beginning of the month, right? No. I mean, Talmud lomar, it says in the Pasuk, Bayomahu. It says on that day. Well, that excludes the entire month, and reduces it down to that very day. Okay, bayom ahu, well, if you're telling me it's that very day, then I could do it while it's still daylight, or during the day. Isn't that a problem? That, I mean, should be accepted. No. Talmud omar ba'avur zeh. It says in the Pasuk, because of this, which means I'm pointing to something specific. What's the specific thing that I'm pointing to? Lo amarti yela b'shasha matzor maror l'murachim lefanecha. The only time that you would point to something is when you have the Pesach, which is Matzah and Maror, accompanied by the Matzah and Maror. That's when you tell the story. That's how I learned it from the Pasuk. So I'm not just asking the question, V'desheno Yodei Lishol. I'm bringing him through the entire answer and how it is that I get to that answer. So I'm developing the whole thing in the, that's brought in the Pesukim. Okay, we have a bit of a picture here of what's going on. Okay? This is important because when you're reading the Haggadah, you just read through this and we don't realize that this is all being drawn from Sukkim in the Torah. The Hachamim are doctoring up stuff over here in the for a good reason, as we'll see, right? In terms of how it is that it presents it in the Haggadah, what are they trying to say? What's the whole point of this over here? Yes?
Probably because of the layout of the Haggadah. To me, this is the first intimation that Yochum Erosh Chodesh is part of the answer to the fourth to that son.
Because of the Haggadah.
I appreciate it, yeah. It's always, it's not shown as...
Sure, that's true. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Shehakol Niyad Baro. It looks like it's usually another paragraph. No, it's right in here, of course. It goes directly with the Pasuk. Okay, excellent, good. So if not for that, it was worth coming tonight. Now, let's think about this. One thing I want to point out. Of these four excerpts from the Torah that we use to identify these four banim, three come from the book of Exodus, one comes from the book of Deuteronomy. Three come from Shemot, one comes from Devarim. It's very important to recognize that difference. Why is it important? We have to think about what Sefer Devarim means and what difference it has, or what the development of Sefer Devarim is in terms of the five books of the Torah. What is Moses' first response to God when HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to hire him for this job? What does he say? He says, not me, why not? Because I can't speak. The way that he says it in Lashon HaKodesh, right, in the Torah, he says, Lo ish devarim anochi. I am not a man of devarim. I'm not a man of words. Who speaks the whole book of Sefer Devarim? Ironically. So somewhere along the line, he picked up some devarim. As a matter of fact, the way the Hachamim put it is, for a man who said, Lo yish devarim anochi, you certainly have a great deal of devarim. You don't stop talking. That's the way that they say it. Literally, it's the way they say it.
It took him 40 years.
What is it? Lovely. It doesn't matter. The point is that there's a development, yes? In other words, there's a point in where, or some, in terms of the development of 40 years, there is a man who is claiming quite honestly to God, Lo ish devarim anochi. I am not a man of devarim, who goes on to speak out the entire book of devarim. It says, Ele devarim asher diber Moshe. These are the words. And the Hachamim pick up on it and say, I mean, for somebody who didn't have so many words, he certainly found his words. 30 days. I mean, it's talking for a month. So in terms of the development, we have to understand what that means. Because where is Moshe come out? Where do we see Moshe first? Shemot. What is Shemot?
Names.
It's interesting. Names, right? Now, if you think about it, names are a very rudimentary element of language. When Moshe says, Lo ish devarim anochi, it's not that he doesn't know how to speak. He can talk. He has words. But he's not a man of dvarim. And that's very different. Names are rudimentary. Why are they rudimentary? Because what must I do in language in order to be able to speak of collectives? In order to be able to talk about a chair, what do I need to recognize? How do I do that? Identify what? Common aspects, right? So I look at similar characteristics that all chairs hold, and I can call this type of structure chair. But we understand, we take this for granted, right? Rudimentary language, as far as human development is concerned, and we still have, you know, in third world areas, situations where this is true, that's a sophisticated development. For me to be able to look at this thing called chair and be able to look at the difference between this chair and any other chair and recognize it as the concept or category chair is an abstract thought. What I usually do, what I normally do in my first interface with the world is I simply recognize this thing. And if I want to name that thing, I don't usually name it, or I wouldn't name it, as an abstract entity. I would name it as a specific entity. This is Shirley. Yeah, that's what I do. Right? This chair is Shirley, that one's Beatrice, that one's John, and so on and so forth. What I would do is I would simply call a name for the object. Because to abstract the object beyond this particular object and what it means to me is a sophisticated thought. We take it for granted, but it's a sophisticated thought. Therefore, shemot, names, are the first mode of language because I just call it something. I don't begin yet to interrelate the elements to each other and begin to create a web of language. Language is a web. I rely, as you do, on a full dictionary running in every person's head when I speak to you, knowing that you know the words that I mean and their definitions. And not only that, you know the nuances of the words that I mean and their definitions. Shall we use an example? The word keep. What are the meanings of the word keep?
A castle.
Sorry?
A castle.
Okay. Keep? Sorry? What does the word mean? Keep doesn't mean God. What does the word mean?
To guard.
Oh, guard. Lishmor. Thank you. I thought you said God. Sorry. It's a language barrier. Acquire. What else? Do you know what one of the number one usages of that word is in English? To keep doing something. You keep telling me over and over. Right, we don't think about that. But all of that is in our minds. We rely on the fact that that is in our minds. And there are plenty of words that we use constantly that none of us know the definition of, yet we use them all the time. What does the word politics mean? What's the actual definition of the word, right? If you had to write the dictionary entry for that word, Not many of us could. Right? You know how to use it. We know that's politics. That's just all politics. What does that mean, politics? What is politics?
It's a Greek
word. Fine. But what does it mean? All it means is the jockeying for power. Plays of power. That's what politics mean. Right? They actually, you know, they asked me this when I was interviewing for my current position. They one of the processes of the interview, I did everything in the interview. It was like a full half-day interview. And one of the things that they asked me to do, they gave me a subject that I had 5 minutes to prepare for. And the subject was Rabbis and Politics Discuss. It's a good thing I knew what the meaning of the word was. And what I said was, as long as you have a cohort of people, you will have politics, by definition. Because it is all we know how to do. It's all a question of where I am in the mix. So it doesn't matter whether it's families, there's politics in families. Doesn't matter whether it's siblings, there's politics among siblings. There's politics among colleagues, there's politics, I mean, except for synagogues. But other than that, there's politics everywhere, right? And everybody knows that in the family, the two-year-old is the one that holds all the power anyway, right? So when I use language, I'm always relying on a web of understanding that I share with everybody, what the words mean. And that's why when you go to another country that is separated by the same language, as was said, right, like America and Britain, suddenly words don't mean the same thing. Same words don't mean the same thing. Yeah, and other words are used for terms, and that puts things off. You feel as though I do anyway, I don't anymore, but I did, right? I still do sometimes, right? I still can't say bathing costume. It's so inappropriate. It's just so inappropriate. It's not a costume. But nonetheless, right, but it's not a suit either, I suppose. So nonetheless, right, we have to deal with these things all the time. Language is an emergent interconnection of terms, concepts, ideas, approaches to the world, how I see the world in my particular context and circumstance. That's Devarim. That's very different than Shemot. The first thing that we see the human doing in the book of the Torah is calling names. God asks Adam, he doesn't even ask him, right? He just suggests that this is what he should do. That he brings the animals, right, before him to see what he might call them. Right? Whatever he calls them, that's the name. He calls Shemot to the animals. So the fundamental element of humanity is to be able to define reality. And the way that I define reality in the most rudimentary way is to call the object something. For me to be able to abstract a category for objects and elements in the world is a sophisticated element of human thought. That develops. So if I could do it with a chair, that's fine. Every child can do it with a chair. They learn what it is. But in order for me to do this in terms of concepts of freedom, of liberty, of self-actualization, these are much more sophisticated and abstract concepts. Not everybody's able to do this and articulate the ideas. All right, it's one thing to be able to think that you can conceive of the ideas, but as Richard Feynman said, if you can't explain something simply, you don't understand it. So it may be that one is absorbing information, but now that I have to actually speak out the information and explain the information is a whole other challenge. This is why people can understand the language but not speak it. You ever hear people say, I understand it, I don't speak it. Well, why not? If you understand it, then you should be able to speak it. If you get the terms, you get the terms. Well, I can get them when they're fed to me. I can't call them out on my own and use them appropriately. And this happens often. It's why when I was a head of school, I insisted that the teachers have the students speak in Hebrew. Now, I used to hire Israeli teachers, and it was the worst catastrophe. Because you think you're hiring Israeli teachers, and they're going to speak Hebrew to the students, and the students will speak Hebrew to them, and the kids will learn Hebrew. Except what used to happen was that the teachers would begin to speak Hebrew, the kids would answer it in English, and then the teacher would speak in broken English back to the kids. And they would say, well, it's just so hard for them. I said, yeah, but the point is that they have to answer you in Hebrew. They can't just listen to you in Hebrew. If they can't answer you in Hebrew, they don't know how to talk the language. This happens often in my classes, unfortunately. Somebody will come, you know, say, oh, Rabbi, that was a great class. Thank you very much. I have no idea what you said, but it was a wonderful class. Right? So it's a question, there's a very big difference between being able to hear and absorb information and give out the information. And that information is given over through Dvarim. It's language. It's understanding concepts. It's understanding how to string concepts together, how to build entire thought in with the words, the names that we use for the world and the concepts and categories. What Moshe is saying is, I'm not a man of Dvarim. Dvarim is a sophisticated element of language. It's where I see the interconnections of my world, and I'm able to articulate those interconnections, recognize the categories of the concepts, and be able to put them out in dialogue and articulate them as such. In order for me to begin to do this, how do I need to see my world? I need to see my world as an integrated whole. I need to be able to see my world as connected. If I look at a chair and I don't realize the common elements of chairs in the world, I can't understand what the concept of chair is. I need to be able to abstract it and see the connections and all the other elements that look like, seem like, act like chair in my world in order for me to be able to do that. So I have to have the ability to be able to see these interconnections. With a chair, it's relatively easy. With concepts like freedom and so on, it's much more difficult. And this is what Moses needs to do. So he knows that when he needs to go and speak to Paro, he can't just say, please let us go. There needs to be an argument made. There needs to be a case set out. There needs to be something put forth that is based in the concepts of what it means to be free and why we should be and what it means to believe in one God and why it is that we are the way that we are.
And Moshe also said, "Ani aralsa
pasayim." Yeah.
Just that question of
speech impediment?
Yeah.
Okay, but he ends up doing dvarim. So at least one thing he gets. No? Yes. I mean, that's achieved. So, who is this person? We imagine that the Chacham is a person that is able to see the world this way. Right? A person that is able to identify a world in terms of its interconnections and its whole, its full capacity. When Moshe speaks of this question, right, that comes up four times in the Torah, at least in terms of how it is that the Pagadah presents it, one comes from the mouth of Moshe in Devarim. That one is the Chacham. The Chacham's question comes from Sefer Devarim. It comes from a perspective of Devarim. It comes from an understanding of a world that is integrated, of an identity that is integrated as well into that world. Let me pause on that for a minute. I don't want anybody to miss that part, because it's very easy for us to miss that. We are very used to looking and thinking about a world as spectators, and we forget that we're actually part of that same world. We are not spectators to this world. We are integrated elements of this world. It's what we are. So although we can be conscious of the world that we inhabit, we also need to be conscious that we are of it as well. We are conscious elements of this universe. We are of the universe. It's not that we're looking at the universe and perceiving the universe. We are the universe. We're elements of this universe. And we are conscious elements of this universe. And it is important for us to be able to recognize that we are embedded within it and conscious of it, through it, in it. Yes? So the Chacham, therefore, comes to this mature realization and recognizes that everything that he is connected. That means that his own identity, he is aware of his own identity as coming from that which came before him. He is not an isolated entity. He is not an entity that spontaneously generated into a world. He is an entity that recognizes comes from that which came before. And he is deeply integrated into that which came before. So his goal is to come to an awareness and understanding of his own in the element of that development that he is, the current expression of that development that he is, and to understand what it means. What he realizes is, if I'm going to look at a world as multifaceted and integrated, I have to be sensitive to what? If I'm looking at a world as multifaceted, and I want to see it as integrated, what must I be sensitive to? Details. Details, details, details. The more detail I am aware of, the more definition I have of my world. The more I see those definitions and details integrated, the better the picture of my world. Simple idea, but true. What we talk about when we talk about definition, what is it in its simplest sense? It's drawing lines. That's it. It's just clear boundaries. That's what definition means. When I define something, I draw a line around it, and I say it is this and not that. That's what a definition is. So when we talk about definition in terms of, let's say, musculature, right? Person has definition. What does that mean? See, clear-cut muscle. Lack of definition, not so clear. Talk about definition on my screen. High definition. What is high definition? Sharp detail that I can see, which is provided by sharp lines. I know where one thing ends and another begins. And we will pay huge amounts of money just to be able to get better definition on my screen. Life is a different question, but my screen I'll pay. And we understand that in order to be able to get high definition in terms of our own lives, we need to have clarity of detail. It's very important. Nuance is essential to the Chacham. Because the more I sense nuance, the more I am aware and clear of the definitions of my world and the interconnections. Does that make sense? Yes? So if I take, you know, it's an old computer screen already. You can't really even do this over here, can't we? Yes, we can. So you take a look at these. If you look at the end, right? Take a look at the end over here. See the little squares in the end? Do you or no? Am I making everybody uncomfortable? There are little squares in these end, in this end. Okay, very, very miniature little squares in this end. This is what we call pixels. Okay, these pixels are really just white boxes. But we need them in order to be able to have the end and the contrast. Now already, these things are so small, nobody sees them anymore. But they're there. So you talk about Apple's Retina display, which is old already. I mean, they're better displays, which are even clearer and sharper and more detailed. And then people used to wonder about the Talmud and wonder why on earth are the rabbis making such a fuss about such minor details? Well, why do you think they are? Because they were not going to suffice with a world that wasn't HD. That's why. They insisted on nuance and detail. They were not going to have a screen that was rough black and white or blurry. Their screen of life was going to be one that was high definition in full, robust detail. And in order to do that, you know what you have to do? You got to worry about every single pixel on the screen. And that's what the whole Talmud is. I mean, the entire discussions, all the discussions of Talmud, people wonder, why are they spending such time on? That's why they're spending on such time. It's very simple. It must be dealt with in order for us to be able to have clarity. So do you know where all of that clarity lies? I mean, you could talk about the Torah as a whole, of course, and the spirit of the law, of course. And you could talk about the general idea of Judaism, of course. And you could talk about the ideals of Israel, yes. But where are the pixels that make the picture? The mitzvot. The details of the Torah. And not only the mitzvot. The edot, the hukim, the mishpatim. A chacham asks a question, and he defines in detail his question. I'm not just asking about the mitzvot. I want to know the details. I want to know the edot. I want to know the chukim. I want to know the mishpatim. I am not asking you as an isolated entity. I am asking you as your child, as your progeny, Hashem Eloheinu, that the Lord God, our Lord, commanded you. Why is it etchem? Because I need to hear from you. That's why. I understand that this is a transference of information. This is transmission. This is something that you are giving to me, that you received from your parents, that they received from theirs. I want to pause here also for a minute. This is important. Do not underestimate the importance of what we call Mesorah. The word Mesorah literally means handing over. When I moser something, and moser in Hebrew means I give it over to you. I entrust you with it. A misora, when a person has a misora, means a person has something that was entrusted to them. Our children cannot maintain connection with Judaism or Israel fully and properly without misora. It just doesn't happen in a vacuum. And it's the responsibility of parents to give it. And you know what happens? Parents that don't have it are already at a loss because not all of us got misora. Not all of us were lucky enough. Somewhere along the way, somebody stole our misora. And they're responsible. And they will answer. One day, some way, somehow, they will answer. And I know that I sound very harsh about this, but it's serious. Because I'm telling you, a child without misora is always at odds. Do not wonder why it is that a child without misora struggles to be able to maintain Judaism, Jewish thought, clarity of what it means to be a member of Israel. They've been given nothing. Not enough. And that's why Hachamir Mazuz, who's Rosh Yeshiva of Kisera Hamim in Eretz Israel, says something very simple but very true. We all are custodians of the misora. If we don't have it, then we don't have it. What are we to do? But if we have it, and we don't give it, we're thieves. Because we have something that is not belonging to us, not ours personally, we're custodians. And we are entrusted to give it over. And if we don't give it over, we're thieves. It's a very serious problem. It's the only way to do it. It's the only way to do it. To have it actually manifest appropriately. So the Hacham recognizes this. And he says, please tell me what it is that he commanded, that our God, commanded you. Now, in the Torah, the response to the Hacham is very beautiful. It's beautiful in the Haggadah as well, but it's looking at something else. What's looked at in the Torah is, well, you're asking us about our things? Let me respond to you. Look on the papers. I bold, right? The collective throughout the entire response. Notice how the response that Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, this is a Hacham who recognizes his integration with the rest of Israel, with his parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, with the identity that he has that is interconnected with the rest of his nation and ultimately the world, with the value of understanding the details in life in order to be able to have high-definition picture of his own life and the world within which he lives, and that it is all a matter of integration. Take a look again. This is what you say to him. Avadim hayinu. We were slaves. Not they were slaves. We were slaves. Avadim hayinu lefarao b'Mitzrayim. Vayotzienu, he took us out. Biyad hazaka. Vayitenu la'etot moftim gedolim v'ra'im Yisrael farao v'chol beto le'aneinu. He did it to our entire household in front of our eyes. Not their eyes. Mine, yours, in front of our eyes. Why are we talking this way? Because it's true. Because where do you stop the tape exactly? I mean, at what point do you edit the history and say, that's where they end and I begin? Where does identity begin? The day you're born? Of course not. Well, then where do you stop it? When do you go far back enough and say, well, I don't have to worry about that anymore? Well, in the Haggadah, you know how far back we go? Just to be able to have a cognitive definition of the entire situation? Metechila of Avodah Zarah you avotenu. Well, let's go pre-Abraham. That's a decent place to at least start the story. His father, Terach, Avi Avraham, Avi Nahor, Yavdu Elohim Acharim, they were worshipping other gods. That's where we start our story. And that's only because we need to have it during the night. We can't just live the rest of our lives telling the story. I mean, the truth of the matter is, if we were to say our full names, it would be eternal. When do you stop? Son of, daughter of, when does that stop? It stops whenever you just don't know anymore. But it's not that it doesn't manifest. It's not that it's not extant, that it doesn't exist in every single cell of your body. I'm serious. That's not an exaggeration. Every single cell of your body has the full information of everything that came before you that makes you you. It's the most astonishing thing on the planet. I mean, it's literally, it's not just some cheap reproduction. So when they say le'aneinu, it's our eyes. Otanu hotzi misham. He took us out of there. Haviotanu, latet lanu, litov lanu, tie lanu, eloenu, tzivanu. Everything, the whole response to the Hacham is us. It's us. It's all about us. It's not about them. It's not about 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. It's not about the kids that are coming. It's me and you, us. This happened to me and you. As much as it happened to them. Which is why, with the Rasha, we say, oh, by the way, if you were there, you wouldn't have come out. Why have to tell him that? Just make him feel bad? No, that's your current state. It's all that way. And that's why we say in the Haggadah, Bechol dor vador, every generation, Hayav Adam leharot et atzmo, kiilu hu yatza mimitzrayim. You have to show yourself, think of yourself, see yourself. The Ashkenazim and Sfaradim have a slightly different nusach. The Ashkenazim have lirot et atzmo, which means you should see yourself as. The Sfaradim say, leharot et asmo, you show yourself as, right? You express yourself as. You yourself left Egypt. So this is the question of the Hacham. So in terms of the Torah, the question itself, the response is us. This is what happened to us. This is our story. It is mine and yours. It is not ancient history. It is now. That's why I often say archaeology is the most non-Jewish profession that there is in the world. Because by the very fact that it's archaic. We don't call it archaeology. It's my yesterday. It's now for me. It's not 1,000 years ago. 1,000 years ago is yesterday. And that's why it says, Kishal bincha mahar, when your son asks you tomorrow. We're not talking about a long time here. And it doesn't really matter how long the time is. I mean, at the end of the day, this is you. There's no difference. So, in the Haggadah, understanding that the Hacham's relationship is understood, what's brought out is the other element of detail. It's halacha. It's understanding. When I tell you eat matzah, well, what's matzah? What's included in matzah? Can it be soft? Can it be hard? Can it be made from rice? And exactly, you know, I mean, is there a time frame involved? And when you say eat, what does eat mean? Can I swallow it whole? Can I crumble it into, you know, into crumbs and take it in a spoon? Do I need to eat it in a certain amount of time? I mean, what if I want to eat it over the entire evening? Is that acceptable? I mean, these are all things that people might roll their eyes at, but it's not something that anyone should roll their eyes at because this is serious questions. If I have something that I'm talking about that I've defined, I need to know the details of that definition. What's eat? What's matzah? Within which time do I consider eating? All of that has to be under. And could you imagine every other mitzvah is exactly the same? Of course, that's what the Hacham wants to know, because if I don't have those things down, I have absolutely no clarity. I just know general broad strokes of life. Should we do that to your phone? Should we do that to your screen that you watch, whatever it is that you watch? I don't even know if anybody has televisions anymore. Do you? Probably. Maybe. I'm serious. How would you like to just go to every movie that was blurry? The screen's just blurry. You'd ask for your money back, wouldn't you? You just don't want to have to be the technician to deal with the pixels. But guess what? In our life, that's what it takes. But all of it is connected. The details are very important because the details can only have meaning and value if they are connected to the entirety. If I see them as integrated. If I see the details expressed from the one God that brought them into being and ultimately an emergent whole that they manifest. You hear that part? So you know what the one halakha is that we tell the Chacham? We say is whatever you want to do tonight, all the stuff that you want to talk about tonight. That, by the way, is the whole idea of story, right? Because we say, kol hamarbe lesaper, you're supposed to tell the story. There's a basic storyline. The more that you tell, the more praised you are. Harez mishubach, more praiseworthy it is. What does it mean, the more that I tell? The more that I count. The more that I detail. The more detail I fill into that story, the better it is. Why? The clearer it is. The more that you can detail and put in counting. You know, that's how they do pixels, by the way. How many pixels per square? The more, the better. It's like thread count in sheets. The more, the better. You don't want some, you know, broad burlap sheets with like four strands of, you know, nobody wants that. They want real fine multi-thread sheets in every little square inch of that thing. That's what we want in terms of our identity and our story. And so you can jump into all the details. But there's one thing that has to start and end, and that is the taste of the matzah. And that's the law. The last thing you eat that night has to be matzah. It's the last taste in your mouth. So that you know, and that's the beautiful thing is that because this is a night of freedom, you know what the Rambam says about dinner? He says, "Ochel kol ma shata rotze lechol, shote kol ma shata rotze lishtot," which is ironic on Pesach because we have nothing to eat. Right? But unless you're Sephardi, then you have a lot of things. Right? He says, "Eat anything that you want to eat. Drink all that you want to drink. Be free." But the last thing that you eat has to be matzah. And if you eat that matzah last, and then you have a strawberry afterwards, or a piece of chocolate, got to eat more matzah. Last thing, the book ends, is a question of your freedom. Your slavery and your freedom. And that's embedded in the matzah. That's included, incorporated in the matzah. So you can talk about all the details you want, Mr. Hacham. But they must all be embedded in the wholeness of your identity and ultimately in the space within which you inhabit. And what is the space that you inhabit? God. The Makom. That's why we call God the Makom over here. Because if I'm going to be free and understand the difference in terms of my choices, understand what my choices mean, understand the consequences of my choices, which is a truly free person, and only that is a truly free person, then I need to be able to know the details, the difference, the nuance, all of it. I need to know all of my options. And I need to know the consequences of my options. And I need to know them within the makom itself, within the dominion of God, within the space that is the very source of existence of this universe. My own existence and everything else that I experience. So that I don't see it as isolated details, but a full matrix of existence and creation, embedded and ultimately brought out by the one who created it all. And brings it out into one entity, integrated entity that is creation in the universe. Do you hear this? Last thing has to be matzah. That's what we tell them. The Rasha is the exact opposite. The Rasha is just as intelligent as the Hacham. But the difference between the Rasha and the Hacham is that the Rasha doesn't see integration. The Rasha always sees himself as an isolated entity, an individual, a person in his own right, who sees the parent, the Mesorah, the transmission, the heritage, the whole thing, as encroaching on his own freedoms. Sees the Torah as an intrusion, not as his identity. That is the difference between the question of Devarim and the three questions in Shemot. Every single one of the three questions in Shemot, on one level or another, see Torah and Israel on one level or another as intrusions. And this is why the Achamim say when we receive the Torah, the experience of receiving Torah first for us was that it was a coercion. It was us being coerced into Torah. Take a look at the bottom of the right column. They stood, it says the Pasuk, at the bottom of the mountain. You know what that tells us when they said that they stood at the bottom or underneath the mountain? It says, it tells us that God took that mountain and held it over their heads like a bucket and said to them, I suggest you take the Torah. If not, we'll just end it all right here. Very, you know, open, peaceful. That's coercion. Okay, so whether this literally happened or not is not important. What's important is that the experience, what they're trying to say over here, is that the experience of receiving Torah from God at Har Sinai was one where we had no out. It was very much a feeling of coercion. To the point that Chazal actually say in the Gemara, they continue the Gemara saying, well, if that's the case, then we don't really have to keep it. I mean, who has to keep something that's under duress? And they answer, yes, that might have been the case until Purim. But by Purim, we became mature enough to realize that we should wear our jacket when we go outside and it's freezing cold, and it's not some intrusion of our parents. It's a good idea. Right? And that's why in Devarim, when Moshe talks about the mitzvah, he says, Letov lanu. It's all us and me. I see myself in this. I see a mitzvah not as something that I have to do, but as my own identity. I see the Torah and Israel and the mitzvot not as something that I must accomplish, but the very nature of my own DNA. It is who I am existentially. It is what I am, not something that I have to do. So the Rasha sees it all as intrusive. Sees himself as an entity, a spectator. There's the stuff out there, and therefore his language is Mavod Azot Lachem. So the Hachamim see that pasuk in the Torah, and they say, what's with the Lachem business? It must mean only one thing. He's looking at himself as isolated. You're you, I'm me, I don't really have much to do with you. Maybe if I like what you say, I'll come into it. You don't recognize that this is your parents, that this is your lineage, this is the nature of who you are, that it does indeed define the very nature of your being, whether you like it or not, and that to deny it is simply to deny an element of your own identity. You know, a person will say, I'm Jewish, I don't practice Judaism. Okay. That's entirely, you know, in your, freedoms, I suppose. It's not faithful. And it's not integrous. Certainly not an integrated identity. But it's, you know, part of free choice, I suppose. But it is also a denial of one's own person. A denial of what it is that a person is. We don't like existential realities. We like psychological realities. Not what I am, but what I wish to be. And so there are certain things that we can be if we wish to be, as long as they are in the purview of what I am. But if I pretend that I am not what I am, well, identity crisis. So the Rasha, why is he called a heretic because of this? I mean, it's one thing to say you, not me. You don't want to be part of the family. You see mom and dad as strangling you, as stifling. All of these mitzvot are encroaching on your freedoms and so on and so forth. But a heretic? Yes. Because you also don't see the unity of the universe as coming from the unity of God. You are able to see yourself as an isolated entity. It's what Einstein called an optical delusion. Look it up. Read the whole text. Einstein talks about this optical delusion that we have, that we actually imagine ourselves as being completely separate and discrete entities from others, when in reality we are deeply integrated with everybody else in the world itself. We are parts of the whole. And to deny that is essentially to deny that there was that there is one creator for all of it, that there is one source for all of it. And therefore we are on some level, at least on an existential level, all integrated. And to refuse to recognize it because I have the capacity to be able to think in those terms is a serious problem. Certainly bordering on the heretical. So that's the Rasha. And so what we say to him is, if you were there, you wouldn't have come out. Lee, if you see yourself as part of the entity, if you see yourself as a member of the enterprise of Israel, and you recognize God as being the source of things, then of course you would have come out. But if all you've got is you, and you're holding yourself up from your own bootstraps, and the only thing you believe in is you, and the only thing that you hold is real, is you, that's not enough. It's not enough. It's not enough for anybody. Nobody can run a life that way. Nobody's enough to be able to be everything. Nobody's big enough to do that. To believe in oneself, only believing in oneself. Not to recognize that we are part of a whole, and that that whole ultimately is powered by God. And so the Rasha is left that way. The Tam, who's very simple, what does he want to do? Why is he at odds with the Chacham? I'm assuming that he's at odds with the Chacham. I'm not saying, it's not necessarily expressed over here. What does he want to do? What does he ask? Mazut. Very simple. What does he want to do? What does Tommy want to do? Tom just wants to keep things very simple. I don't want to hear about the complicated. Don't get complicated. Just keep it very simple. Just can't keep it simple. Keep it simple. You know, kiss. Keep it simple, stupid. Right? That's Tom. He wants kiss. Keep it simple. Mazot. He's not like the Hacham that's breaking everything down, trying to understand the nuance and detail of the full color of his world. Ma'edot, v'achukim, v'amishpatim. He's not interested in the halachot and the details. He just wants to know, like, what do I have to do? Just tell me, what is this? Can you give me, like, a very basic answer? Very simple answer? Look, it's not bad. He's just Tom. Simple Tom. And Tom just wants to keep things simple for his whole life. The problem is, you know what the problem is? Things aren't simple. That's what the problem is. Things are complex. And they become more and more and more complex as time goes on. And that's why a symptom of old age is Tomness. I'm sorry to say, but it is. There comes a point in life where you just don't want to do it anymore. I don't know, it's too complicated. Just simple. Just keep it simple. Simple, simple, simple. The funny thing is, all the complexity is trying to make things simpler and simpler and simpler. It used to be much more complicated to do things. You know? If you wanted to take a picture, you had to bring a camera along. Yeah. Talk about complicated. You got to plan. Oh, I forgot my camera. Right? Remember those days? Yeah. Doesn't even exist. Those days don't exist anymore. Everybody's got a video camera, a still camera. Phone. Nobody uses it as a phone anymore, but nonetheless, it's in there. I mean, the flashlight. You know, you used to have a whole kit in your car. You know, you used to have a whole kit in your car with all the utensils. It's all in there. You've just got it. It's all in the phone. Everything's in here. I have a full Jewish library in this thing. You understand? The whole Talmud and the Rambam and everything else that wrote anybody else on it. It's all in my phone with a search. Nobody needs to know anything anymore. It's just all on your phone. That's all you need. Just need to know what you're looking for. That's all. Simple. Simple. Except it's complicated. There is no such thing really as simple. Yes, one can live in a simple world. And you know where we find simplicity? In the world of children and the world of the elderly. And that's why they do very well together. Seriously. I just visited a few months ago, probably about 4 or 5 months ago, I visited an early childhood program that integrates with the elderly. It's the most beautiful thing. And you just feel so, I felt terribly out of place, right? Because I'm thinking so complicated, but it's not complicated at all. Everything's very, very simple. And it's wonderful. But the bottom line is, because I'm just stuck there in the middle, I'm neither. And the problem is that children have to at one point learn to complicate or to get into complexities. Perhaps that's a better term than complicated, right? Complexities are a reality. And the truth is, that as we grow, we generally do end up becoming more complex and more sophisticated. We don't just want a hamburger anymore. We might want a more nuanced meal. We might want to be able to taste a wine and the differences between this bottle and that bottle. We might want to be able to be stimulated by nuanced thought and ideas until we feel like we are not in comfort anymore. Tom just wants things to be simple, which is fine unless he stays there. Tom can't stay Tom. Tom's okay as long as he's Tom. But once Tom starts getting more complex and his world starts getting more complex and he doesn't move along with the times, do you know what he is? He's a Rasha. Tom has the potential to either be a Hacham or a Rasha. And that is why we've got to be very careful with Tom. So what do we say to him? Well, when you say mazot, which is a very simple question, amarta elav, what we say to him is, bechozik yad hotziyano noyim emisraim bet avadim. It's the exact same as the pasuk. Nothing changes for Tom. Right? That's the beautiful thing. Everybody else, we get into ideas, we develop, the Haggadah says one thing, the Torah says another, the Rasha, just as intelligent as the Hacham, he just has different terms of how it is that he sees things in the integration. Tom's very simple, we keep the answer in the Torah, that the answer is given to him in the Haggadah. Nothing changes. Very simple, very simple. Except that there's some hidden elements in there, which I don't have for you on the pages, but you listen to, and you look in the Haggadah. This pasuk, Bechozek Yad Hotziyana Adonai Mimisraim Bet Avadim, is used in the Haggadah. It's broken down in the Haggadah, and it is elaborated on. It has glosses by the Hachamim. And they say, Chozek Yad. Do you know what Chozek Yad is? Chozek Yad is Dever. Dever is pestilence, plague. Yad Adonai Hoya, how do I know that? Because it says the hand of God is extended b'miknecha, b'sadeh, b'susim, b'hamorim, b'gemalim, b'tzon. It's in the camels, it's in the livestock, in the sheep, and so on and so forth. Everybody's dever kaved me'od, a very heavy, heavy pestilence. Dever. You know how to spell dever? Do you know why it's called that? It's when everything breaks down. When the whole system breaks down. When integration breaks down, when health breaks down, when clarity breaks down, you find yourself in pestilence, plague, breakdown. Everything just falls apart. And that's why it's called Dever. That's when Devarim just don't work anymore. And you know when it usually comes in the Torah? When we start pulling things apart. When we start breaking things down. The best one, the most prominent example, is when King David decided to take a census of the people. Not a good idea. Wasn't a good idea. He decided he was going to take a census. It's just an entire plague of Dever ensued. It says, Yad Adonai Yotziyan Olam Yisrael Mibet Avadim. So it says, where are we? Yeah, so this is the response to the entire problem. So although Tom seems very simple, Tom is always at the risk of being too simple. Take a look at Einstein's quote in the second column, second to last. Everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. Yeah?
Taking this analogy, I find that Tom has chosen the middle way. And he's a happy person.
He's extreme. Yeah. Do you know why he's a happy person?
Yes.
Because ignorance is bliss. Until it smacks you right in the face and you realize that you really need some information fast. It's just the way it is. So he wants to be able to remain ignorant. Tom's in trouble. Then, of course, there's a person who hasn't even begun to learn yet, and with this we will end. So much so that he doesn't know how to ask questions, right? And that's why I believe it's very important. It's important to understand this. There is a certain amount of learning that is necessary in order to know the questions to ask. So people asked me, and I was giving over halakha. And I was giving over concepts in halakha. And I gave over concepts in halakha that usually, you know, rabbis study, not lay people. And people criticized me for giving over these concepts in halakha. I wasn't trying to make rabbinic authorities of my audience. I wasn't trying to make poskim out of my audience. I was trying to educate my audience to know how to ask questions. Because if you don't know what the issues are, you can't ask the questions. If you don't know what is rabbinic in nature, what comes from the Torah, what the principles are of Shabbat, what the ideas are in terms of how it is that I'm supposed to act, not act, what I'm supposed to do and not do, I don't even know how to begin to ask the questions. What I should do, what I shouldn't do, is this okay, is this not? I don't even know what it is. The She'eino Yodea Lishol hasn't opened his eyes yet. So do you know what we do for him? So it's interesting, the She'eino Yodea Lishol also has the potential of being a Rasha, which is why the Pasuk that's used for him in Torah is the Pasuk that we end up using for the Rasha in the Haggadah. Because he just stays, not really wanting to know. I don't know how to ask questions. But you should know how to ask questions. I don't. Well, that's your fault. It's one thing if you haven't learned anything yet, but you have the potential to learn, so you're tam, and then you remain tam, and you fell into she'enoyo de'ali shol because things got away from you, and now you have no idea what's going on. The essence of freedom is knowledge. If I don't know my options, and I don't know my consequences, I am not free. I can have all the liberty in the world, do whatever it is that I wish to do. But if I don't know what I do will yield, and what my possibilities of doing are, I'm not a free man. I need to be a hacham in order to be free. The Rasha is incarcerated because he's locked himself into himself. And so there's a tremendous limit in terms of his identity, the robustness of who he is, and what he can be. The Chacham is open to every possibility. Is it unstable? Is it unsettling? Yes, I don't know what the answer is going to be. Is it uncertain? Yes. But every good thinker lives in uncertainty. Because I don't know yet the full answer. I have working definitions, but I don't know all the answers. And we know that the wise man is not the person who has all the answers. The wise man is the person who knows that he doesn't have all the answers, but is interested in finding out. Isn't that true? Isn't that the person that we recognize as being wise? For some reason, when the person claims to have all of the answers, we just don't recognize that person as being wise. But the Rasha claims to have all the answers. Sure, he's asking the question, but he's not really asking the question. He's saying, what's the stuff you're doing over here? I mean, as though he's some anthropological, you know, explorer trying to understand what this crazy family is doing. I suppose.
I don't think you're suggesting that the Chacham is a perfect person.
No.
Yeah. So is he all those other things, Tam and Rasha, and Enoya Be'adishon, and then through a process he becomes the Chacham?
It's very likely.
Becoming.
It's very likely. In other words, what you're saying is it possible that these stages are part of the same person at different parts, at different points in life? Of course. Maybe not everybody, but definitely possible that that we go through these different stages in our lives. And it's very possible that we are in different stages of these lives with different things. In other words, I may be a hacham in terms of, you know, raising kids, but I might not be a hacham in terms of what it means to be Jewish. Although that might, you know, connect somewhere on some level if I'm Jewish and my kids are Jewish. You know, I mean, I'm going to need some of that. But whatever it is, of course, yes. This could be the same person, absolutely. And of course, we know there aren't only four people in the world, right? I mean, there are nuances, of course, in terms of the people. And these are mix and match. These are talking about approaches to life in the world and how it is that we see things in a paradigmatic sense. So the She'enoyo Dali Shvel, do you know what we do for him? We teach him how to think. We don't just give him an answer in the Haggadah. We tell him, look, I mean, if you're not going to do anything, you're going to fall into being a Rasha, which is why the same Pasuk for the Tam in the Torah is used as for the Rasha in the Haggadah. Same Pasuk. But what we will do is open the door to you, not with an answer, to learn how to think. Let's look at the Pasuk, shall we? And that's what we do to the She'enoyo Dali Shol. We say, well, here's a Pasuk. Shall we examine the Pasuk? First of all, the pasuk, right? Again, al petachu yobanam shenamar v'gadar b'incha b'yom ulemor ba'avur zeh asad onaydi b'siti b'nisraim. That's our pasuk. So we say to him, v'gadar b'incha. What are the implications of that, Mr. She'enoyo Dali Shol? We get him to start thinking in basic Talmudic form. Think about what the implications of the words are. V'gadar b'incha. Tell your child. When should I tell my child? Yachol mirosh chodesh. I mean, I guess start the beginning of the month. No, I mean, that makes sense. Get ready when the month starts. I mean, you know, Pesach's coming. Everybody knows Rosh Chodesh Nisan, Pesach is coming. Well, I mean, yes, except for the fact that the Pasuk continues, doesn't it? V'gadar b'incha b'yom ha'hu, on that day. So that qualifies v'gadar b'incha, a logical progression. It restricts v'gadar b'incha to b'yom ha'hu. Well, okay, b'yom ha'hu is a 24-hour period, which would include daylight. Does that include daylight? Well, remember that it says Ba'avur Zeh, which restricts it further and qualifies it further. What we're doing is we're teaching the She'enoyo Dali Shol to think. We're bringing him into the world of thought to be able to take what it is that he sees in the world and parse it so that it can be put back together in higher definition. And that's an important part of it, because you can parse something and leave it parsed. Or parse something and put it back together in higher definition. Now you know the details. The difference of a child walking into a botanical garden, just being enamored by the beauty, and a botanist walking into a botanical garden, recognizing the beauty, but also understanding the intricacies of what it is that this person is seeing and experiencing that's put out by the world. Lo shekarav zel zeh, it's just completely different. Not to be compared. So the essence of Pesach, ma nishtana. What changed? What's difference? That's really the whole essence of the question of freedom and thought. What's the difference? And that has to be asked. Afilu kulanu chachamim, as it says in the Haggadah. Even though we're all wise men, kulanu nevunim, we're all understanding people. Mitzvah alenu lesaper, we are commanded to tell, to count, to insert detail, to be able on our level to understand the nuanced nature of the nature of our identity and our freedom, of our slavery and our freedom, of our life and all that it entails. So it's always manishtana. It's just a question on what level am I mishtane? On what level am I recognizing nuance and differentiation? And as I grow and as I develop, those nuances, details, differences enhance my entire vision and understanding of life. As long as the last thing that I taste is the matzah. That I understand that all of it happens within the realm, within the place, the makom of God, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the Holy One. And that my life exists in that place. That everything that I see is expressed from that place, bound by that place, united within the force of that place. And that it starts with my matzah in slavery, and I end with matzah and freedom, and that is the entire story of my life. The nuances and details, by all means, but it's all in there. So that's our treatment, essentially, of the four sons and the elements of freedom and its relationship, ultimately, to Ilchot Deot. Yeah, because we understand, of course, that the Hacham is a person that's integrated into the world with Da'at, the Rasha pulls away with his Da'at, and the Tam doesn't really want a tremendous amount of Da'at, and the She'eno Yodeh Lishol doesn't even have Da'at yet. We try to provide it for him. Yes?
You start off by saying Rasha is still there. So
Rasha is still there?
He's still at the Seder table.
Yeah.
So he hasn't left yet. So, you know, as parents, we're told, look, if your child is presented, you love him.
Yes.
Show them and you try and draw them in. This is the exact opposite.
I'm glad you asked that question. Because that question of what do you do with a child that's rebelling, that you try to draw them in. I will be honest with you. I've personally been struggling with this a great deal lately. Thank God I've been blessed with many, many pupils, with many Talmidim, around, you know, all over. And I love them very, very much. Because I believe that we share something very precious in our understanding of Torah, our sharing of Torah, our discussions of Torah. Of all ages. And some of them are rebellious. And the question is, what does one do in that situation? It's a difficult question to answer because everything must be treated within its context. But there is this. Part of freedom is recognition. We will find in the next chapter of Deot that this is brought out by the Rambam, that when one is ill of mind or confused, the first step to addressing it is to be aware of the confusion. And that lack of awareness is a problem. So you try to bring somebody into awareness first. The question is the bringing of into awareness a possibility? Or does one run the risk of losing the individual in the process of bringing one to awareness? It's a very sensitive thing and has to be dealt with tremendous da'at and care. So the Hachamim give us a general klal, a general principle, that we should always be small dochevi amin mekarev. That I can't just allow for everything and be all-inclusive loving because it throws away all definition and detail and standard. And so I push away with the left hand, which is the weaker hand, usually, right? But I bring close with the right hand. So there should be elements of definition and rule and standard and so on. I don't just give in because I love. But at the same time, the love is an element that I'm supposed to use to bring close. So there's these ideas that we have situations where people just don't have the clarity of being able to even begin to tell the difference. And when that's the case, there's no freedom. And if there's no freedom, then there's major question in terms of how a person is responsible. But there comes a point in where a person has opportunity to learn. If they do, and they don't learn, that's a different story. Right? And so so there's all levels of this. Right? There's all levels of how much one knows and what one is going through in one's life and what clarity a person has and what are the baggage that a person brings and so on. Right? All major, major, major issues. And so it's a very sophisticated thing to deal with in real time and practical situations, and people really, there's halachot and rules and, you know, guidance as far as this is concerned. But every single case is its own world. And has its own details. And therefore, it's not something that I would answer in terms of a textbook answer. I think that there's a need to be able to maintain relationship most of the time, not all the time. Here, clearly, with the Rasha, it's almost not. I mean, it's essentially saying that Rasha, listen, if you were there, you wouldn't have been, you would have...
Saying, don't bother coming next year.
It's almost saying that. Although there's a hope that the Rasha, upon hearing that he wouldn't have been there, may be asking, what do you mean I wouldn't have been there? And that we engage them with that conversation. Although, yes, there's always that possibility, unfortunately. Chag Kasher V'Sameach. Okay.